Well, welcome to all of you. I am Rabbi Ed Staffman, and it's a great honor to be invited to address you this morning. In fact, I've been in Bozeman a little over 10 years, and this is the fifth time I've been honored to address you in that time. And I said to Beth just this morning that in your wildest dreams, did you ever think that I'd be invited five times to the Unitarian Church? And she said, honey, you're never in my wildest dreams. But it is especially an honor to be here with you, and I'm so glad to see so many friends and my good friend Duffy, your minister, who I have enormous respect and love for. So thank you. You know, as many of you know, I recently retired just about a month ago from the pulpit at Congregation Beth Shalom, and I'm already missing many things. But what I don't miss is some of the disagreements about the way things ought to be. The two chief complaints that I received over these 10 years, the first one was that there's too much Hebrew in the service. And the second one is that there's not enough Hebrew in the service. But not long before I retired, one of my most beloved congregants had come to me, and he was being gently critical when he said, "You know, Rabbi, I'd like to see more of that old-time religion in our service and in our congregation." Now, I guess he was probably referring to however it was he experienced religion as a boy. But as I thought about his comment, I realized he was absolutely right. In fact, the decline of all progressive religion in America is precisely because we've lost touch with that old-time religion. You know, religion that sounds like this. It was good for the Hebrew children, etc., etc. So what would old-time religion of the Hebrew children look like in the 21st century? Old-time religion begins, of course, with the Torah, what some would call the Old Testament. And if we want religion today that is relevant and lives and breathes, we need more Torah, much more Torah. Let me give you just a few examples to show you that the Torah is the most politically, economically, and socially radical document in all of human history. First, the Torah teaches us that each of us is made in the image of God. Now, these words are so often repeated these days that they may seem so thin, so banal. This is a failure of language, for to try to render human worth in words is to necessarily do violence to those to what lies beneath the words. The concept is post-linguistic, or as the mystics say, ineffable. In fact, to say that we are each made in God's image sounds like a platitude that wouldn't seem out of place on a Hallmark card. But understanding the historical context and contemplating deeper truth causes these words to glow with the force of revealed truth. You see, in a culture where the Pharaoh or king was universally seen as God's earthly representative, and everybody else lacked intrinsic value, the Torah came and radically taught that each of us, like a king or a pharaoh, is made in the image of God with all of the corresponding worth and value. Like so many of the other examples I'll give you today, while this verse may seem like a platitude, consider that a platitude is what is left of truth after it has been drained of all emotion. Our job is to resaturate the dried husk with feeling to see it again for what it is, one of the most powerful and most deeply rooted truths hidden in plain sight. And then to live our lives and carry on our relationships and our politics in a way that honors this deep underlying truth. A few more brief examples of the Torah's radical notions. Where wealthy kings and pharaohs dictated the details of their subjects' lives, Torah created radical workers' rights with a guaranteed day of rest each week, even for slaves and animals. Even the land gets to rest every 7 days. In a culture where slavery was common, Torah radically required that every 7 years, slaves had to be set free and paid generously for their labor. In a culture where women were seen as property, Torah radically offered inheritance rights of women, for women. In a culture with grossly disparate wealth distribution, the Torah radically required the periodic redistribution of all wealth, saying, and I quote, "There shall be no poor people among you." In a culture where war was perpetual, Torah radically limited war to self-defense. In a culture with a primitive value system, Torah radically required ethical eating and consumerism, ethical treatment of animals and the earth's resources, and the love of not only one's neighbor as oneself, but especially the love of the stranger, because we deeply know through our story what it feels like to be an oppressed stranger. And perhaps most important, the Torah radically demands that we be a community of doers that actively promote the values we hold dear. And that's just the Cliff Notes version. Our radical old-time religion isn't limited to the five books of Moses either. In our sacred texts which follow the Torah, the critical message is that God doesn't much care about the way the show we put on, but what God wants is for you, individually, and even more so as a community, say the prophets, to take care of one another, especially the poor, the widow, and the orphan. The revolutionary nature of old-time religion is most certainly not limited to Judaism. Jesus was a Jew who understood the Torah and became a revolutionary who stood up to the oppressive Roman government. Muhammad introduced revolutionary ideas to the Arab world, overthrowing the corrupt political wealth structure of his time. The Dalai Lama calls for a spiritual revolution as he lives in exile from the Chinese government. Martin Luther King's old-time religion stood up to the racist American power structure. And did I mention Pope Francis, who's returning 21st century Catholicism to its old-time roots? Challenging the status quo at every turn, he urges politicians and business leaders, quote, to seek a new economic model to help the poor and to shun policies that sacrifice human lives on the altar of money and profit. And then there's his encyclical on climate change, elevating human dignity and the needs of poor populations over pure economic concerns. My point is that old-time religion was and always will be revolutionary, coming to offer a balance to human power, wealth accumulation, and arrogance. Old-time religion doesn't make us comfortable in particular, but challenges us by reminding us that we're just here for the weekend, and everything we think we own and control is merely borrowed from the creation which belongs to a higher source. When we ask why religion is irrelevant to so many people today, we need look no further than our drifting away from old-time religion. The kind described by Rabbi Heschel, who Jan quoted today, in this quote, "Religion is a critique of all satisfaction. Its end is joy, but its beginning is discontent, detesting boasts, smashing idols. It began in Ur Kasdim, in the seat of a magnificent civilization, yet Abraham said, no, breaking the idols, breaking away. And so every one of us must begin saying no to all visible, definable entities pretending to be triumphant, ultimate." End of quote. Friends, last week, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, where I visited the Civil Rights exhibit at the Frist Museum. If you ever get that way, I highly recommend it. And later in the week in Birmingham, Alabama, where I visited the Civil Rights Museum there for the second time. And my visits reminded me that 2018 is the 50th anniversary of MLK's death in 1968, which in turn reminded me that 2 years ago, I had the privilege of traveling to Selma for the 50th anniversary of the historic march led by Martin Luther King to gain voting rights for African Americans. I went to commemorate those who participated with Dr. King 50 years ago, but once there, I discovered that I had not come for a commemoration, but for a personal and holy recommitment. I came there hoping for the same spirit would grab me that grabbed marchers 50 years ago. As I marched in Selma over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, as King and his followers had done 50 years earlier, it was not lost on me that the bridge continues to carry the name of a KKK member and white supremacist. Nor was it lost on me that Martin Luther King marched for voting rights, which are now going rapidly backwards. This visit got me thinking about the incredible moment in the Jewish tradition where God says to Moses, "Your children have rejected me with a golden calf, a false idol. I'm going to destroy them." And at that moment, a light bulb goes off, and Moses says to himself, "Talui bi," this thing, this potential destruction of my people, "Talui bi," it falls on me, it hangs on me. The catastrophe that's unfolding, "Talui bi," it hangs on me. And Moses rushed down the mountain and intervened. This call to action, it hung on Moses. It hung on the prophets. It hung on Jesus. It hung on those who went to Selma 50 years ago. And now, my friends, the human rights challenges of our day, they hang on me. They hang on you. They hang on us. All of us. So how might the radical principles of Torah I laid out earlier look in a 21st century Torah? Much the same as they looked then. Examples. In a culture where many groups have been historically disenfranchised, the Torah requires that we offer fair opportunities in voting and wages and healthcare and education to all humans because we are all made in the image of God. In our culture of grossly disproportionate wage distribution, where 46 million Americans, including 10 million working people, live in poverty, while the average CEO makes 350 times the average worker, the Torah's command that there be no poor among you translates as those who work are entitled to a living wage. In a culture that still maintains a primitive value system, we need to seriously reaffirm our commitment to Torah's radical requirement of ethical eating and consumerism, ethical treatment of animals, ethical use of Earth's resources, and ethical use of time, which demands that once a week we get off the treadmill of producing and just be what we Jews call Shabbat. We must reaffirm in our lives Torah's demand for radical justice, always recalling her most repeated verse, that we not oppress the stranger, because we deeply know what it feels like to be the oppressed stranger. And finally, our radical 21st century Torah demands that leaders of different faiths come together as a community, as of doers that fight for our overwhelmingly common values. To really live by all of this would return us to an old-time religion that is relevant once again. But we won't return to old-time religion with the left-right argument. It won't happen with the Democrat versus Republican argument. As Reverend Barber teaches, we need a deeper argument. An argument that goes deep into the root of the soul, that goes beyond platitudes, and it elevates us above the negativity. We need a moral focus that doesn't just curse the darkness, but says we can. We can if we come together around our deepest principles. If we listen to the words of our sacred texts, which teach us to feed the hungry and clothe the naked. We need to hook up again, as Jews and Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and UUs, and people who are not of faith but believe in a moral universe, as Democrats and Republicans, as gay and straight, as business leaders and workers, as the unemployed, doctors, the uninsured, the students, the parents, and stand together to lift up and defend our most sacred principles. Talui bi, it hangs on me. Talui bi, it hangs on me. We come together today as a community with the enormous power and resources of both old-time religion and humanist reason. We come together to connect to our core principles and, yes, to pray. But Rabbi Heschel taught that, quote, prayer must be a place for deepening concern over other people's plight. Prayer, he says, is meaningless unless it is subversive, unless it seeks to overthrow and to ruin the pyramids of callousness, hatred, opportunism, falsehoods. He says the liturgical movement must become a revolutionary movement, seeking to overthrow the forces that continue to destroy the promise, the hope, the vision. And prayer, not verified by conduct, is an act of desecration and blasphemy. 50 years after Dr. King has left us, I ask you, are we still able to stand up today and say, let my people go? Because Rabbi Heschel isn't coming back. Dr. King is not coming back. But are there children here? Are there students still around? Please, God, I pray, give us back some of that old-time religion.